Perhaps you are a past friend of WILL who has let your membership lapse, but recently you find yourself listening more and more to news and information here on AM 580. Our new member enrollment period is a great time to come back as a friend of WILL. You can call us right now at area code 217-333-0850 with a pledge of $40 or more, and we will send you the next 12 issues of Patterns. That's our monthly program guide. As an additional thank you, we'll be sending a bar of European chocolate stamped with our new member campaign message, which is members are the heart of WILL. This also would be a good time to do it today because we have a challenge from a listener named Sally who lives in St. Joe, who has been a friend of WILL for 10 years. She says she would like to help encourage new people to call and join her in supporting public radio. She will add $250 to our pledge total when at least 20 new or lapsed members call in today with a contribution. So we hope if you're not a friend or it's been a while, you would rejoin. And you can do that very easily by calling us now at 217-333-0850. Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Thanks for tuning in. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking with anthropologist and ethnobotanist Wade Davis. And we'll be talking about his book, Shadows in the Sun, the subtitle, Travels to Landscapes of Spirit and Desire. It's published by the Island Press. It is a collection of essays which look at indigenous cultures and the way that they relate to, depend upon the natural world. Wade Davis has a Ph.D. in ethnobotany from Harvard. Through the Harvard Botanical Museum, he spent over 3 years in the Amazon and the Andes as a plant explorer. His later work took him to Haiti to investigate folk preparations implicated in the creation of zombies, an assignment that led to his writing Passage of Darkness and also The Serpent and the Rainbow, which was a bestseller and was later released as a motion picture. He has written a number of other books, including Panan, Voice for the Borneo Rainforest, Nomads of the Dawn, One River, The Clouded Leopard, Rainforest, and one that's to come out this year titled The Light at the Edge of the World. He is a native of Canada. He has done many different sorts of work. He's been a park ranger, a forest engineer, a big game hunting guide, and has also conducted ethnographic field work among several indigenous societies of northern Canada. He's written for both the scientific and the popular press. He's lectured at a lot of different places, including the American Museum of Natural History, the Smithsonian, the National Geographic Society, the Field Museum. He was also the host and co-writer of Earth Guide, a television series that ran on the Discovery Channel, and he is joining us this morning by telephone to talk a little bit about Shadows in the Sun. As we talk, you should feel free, that is, you folks who are listening, should feel free to be a part of the conversation. We ask only that callers are brief, and we ask that so that we can accommodate as many different people as would like to call in, and also so that we can keep things moving along, but anybody listening is welcome to join the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You match the letters with the numbers on the phone, you get WILL, so 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Davis, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You know, here at this institution, probably a lot of other places where there are educators, we talk a lot about cultural diversity, or at least we use that term. It's sort of the buzzword of the time. But I think looking at your book and thinking about the kinds of things that you've done and the places that you've gone puts a whole new spin on that phrase, because I think when we use it, we're talking about certainly people of different ethnic backgrounds and experiences getting to know one another, but we're really all part of the same culture.
Right. This is we use that term often, David, we're thinking of how do we incorporate various different ethnicities of individuals who move to America, and then somehow we come to terms with this, the myth of the American melting pot. But I think when I speak of cultural diversity, in some sense, I'm speaking more about the the wonder of the total human mosaic. You know, I think it's probably pretty clear that 100 years from now, this century won't be remembered for its wars or its technological innovations, but it'll be remembered as the era in which we stood by and either actively endorsed or passively accepted the massive loss of both biological and cultural diversity, because, of course, they go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. You know, at one point, there were probably 15,000 languages spoken on the Earth, and a language isn't just a cluster of words or a grammar or vocabulary. It's a flash of the human spirit. It's a vehicle through which the soul of a culture comes into the material world. And today, we probably have 6,000 languages spoken, but there are only 300 of them that are spoken by more than 100,000 people, and the vast majority are not being taught to children, which means that they're effectively already dead. And some linguists think that in another century, there'll be as few as 350 languages. So we're living through a period of some kind of condensation to some kind of generic, I think, blandly amorphous world culture that will be a different place, and I think a less poetic place than the one into which we were born.
Mm. Some people, I think, when you talk about biological diversity, are willing to accept the importance of diversity for its own sake. Other people, you may be able to make a utilitarian kind of argument for preserving at least plant species and perhaps also animal species. But it seems that it gets a little bit more difficult when you're talking about preserving an indigenous culture. How do you persuade someone that, in fact, that's important?
Well, I think the great revelation of anthropology, David, is the idea that the world into which we are born does not exist in some absolute sense, but it's just a model of reality, the consequence of one particular set of adaptive choices that our lineage made. But the great revelation of anthropology is the fact that there are other ways of thinking, other ways of being, other ways of interacting with the earth. And here we are living in the midst of this sort of ecological challenge, which is the nature of the environmental movement, for example, at this part of the 20th century. And yet we can't seem to find a way out. Well, maybe there's some lessons that we can draw from these different cultures. You know, we have this kind of romantic notion of indigenous cultures as being somehow inherently closer to the land than we are. But this is kind of a Thoreauian or a Rousseauian idea that almost is a caricature. In fact, indigenous people are neither sentimental nor weakened by nostalgia, but they have nevertheless forged through time and history and ritual a traditional mystique of the earth that's based not on a self-conscious idea of being close to the earth, but on a far subtler intuition, the idea that the earth itself only exists because it is breathed into being by human consciousness. Now, what does that mean? It means that a kid in the high Andes raised to believe that a mountain is the abode of a spirit is not only going to be a fundamentally different child than an American kid brought up to believe that that mountain is a pile of rock waiting to be mined, but that Peruvian kid's going to have a different relationship to the mountain than an American kid. By the same token, a Kwagyuth child from the coast of British Columbia, where I was born, who sees the forest as the abode of Hukuk and the crooked beak of heaven and the cannibal spirits that live at the north end of the world, is going to be a different human being than a Canadian lad who was raised to believe that a forest exists to be cut. So I think that part of what we need to learn to celebrate is not just that the traditional knowledge, say, of indigenous people may provide, as you say, utilitarian products, whether it's medicinal plants from the Amazon or, a key to some kind of practical information from some other part of the world, but really understand that these cultures represent whole different visions of life itself, and that somehow diversity is not just a foundation of stability, as the ecologists dryly teach, but it in some sense is an article of faith, a fundamental indication of the way things are supposed to be.
Mm. It seems to be the case with the people that you write about, that their cultures and their way of life is tied to the place where they live, and just in the same way that we've seen a reduction in diversity as a result of habitat destruction, is that an issue for indigenous people if we lose the kind of place where they live, or it becomes less?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, all around the world, you keep running up against the horrible realities of the century, whether it's Yanomami people being overwhelmed by mineral exploration or Inuit narwhal hunters being threatened by oil exploration, or the peoples of Nigeria and the Niger Delta who are living in an environment that is no longer habitable by human beings. I mean, you see the destruction of the biosphere happening with, you know, with some consistency in all over the planet. And I think that this is obviously an issue of tremendous concern. And I think that, you know, I'm not sure if anyone can change anything. I've always thought that people who think they can, you know, change the world are probably not only wrong, but perhaps even dangerous. But at least we do have the obligation, and certainly as a writer, I have the obligation, as I try to do in this book, Shadows in the Sun, to at least bear witness to what's going on and bear witness to the wonder of these different visions of life itself. I mean, you know, I spent time in the Arctic, for example, with Inuit, and you know, it's fascinating to see the wonder of their adaptation. You know, when the British first came, or the European explorers in general first came to the Arctic, they took the Inuit to be savages. The Inuit, for their part, took the Europeans to be gods. Both were wrong, but one did more to do honor to the human experience. And what the British failed to recognize is that there could be no better measure of genius than the capacity to survive in that harsh environment on a technology that was limited to what you could carve from bones and stone and small bits of wood and bone that floated up from the sea. And the Inuit exemplified a people who get by with nothing. And they didn't fear the cold, they took advantage of it. The runners of their sleds, for example, were actually three fish put into a line and wrapped in caribou hide and greased with the contents of the caribou's stomach. I heard an old story, which I later verified, of an elder who refused to enter a settlement in the 1950s, and the family took away all of his tools and all of his weapons, hoping that that would force him into the settlement. But David, it didn't. He walked out in the middle of the Arctic night, in the middle of a snowstorm, pulled down his caribou hide trousers, defecated into his hand. While the feces froze, he honed it into the shape of a blade. It froze as hard as steel. With that knife, he then killed a dog, skinned the dog, took the sled, the rib cage of the dog, and made a sled, took the skin of the dog and made a harness, harnessed up an adjacent dog, and disappeared over the ice floe. Now, talk about getting by with nothing. Mm. And, you know, you can see these little points of wonder all over the world, whether it's a Warani hunter in the Amazon who can smell animal urine at 30 paces and tell you what species left it behind, or whether it's a voodoo priestess in Haiti who, possessed by the spirits, handles burning embers with impunity, or the Mazatec in the mountains of Oaxaca, who actually communicate across the broad valleys of their homeland with whistles by mimicking the intonation of their tonal language. They have these complex messages that and discussions and conversations across landscape. It's like a vocabulary based on the wind. And I just find it inherently fascinating that human beings have been able to come up with all these unique adaptations. And the, you know, counterpoint to that is a tragedy that comes about when you travel in a place like Tibet, as I have, and you come into a landscape where through the activities of one people, in this case the Chinese, over 1.2 million Tibetans were killed, and 6,000 monasteries, ancient temples of wisdom and veneration, were reduced to riprap and piles of dust. So you can't help but bear witness to this and to try to do your bit to write about it.
Let me reintroduce our guest, and we have a caller we'll get right to. Wade Davis is an anthropologist and ethnobotanist. He has written a number of books and many articles, both scientific and popular, on subjects ranging from Haitian voodoo, Amazonian myth and religion, the global biodiversity crisis, the traditional use of psychotropic drugs, and the ethnobotany of South American Indians. And his book here that we're talking about this morning is titled Shadows in the Sun. It is published by the Island Press, and it's a collection of essays about indigenous people, various places around the world, and their way of life. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. We have a caller here locally in Urbana to talk with on line one. Hello.
I just wanted to know the name of the book that was made into a movie. I didn't get that.
Oh, that was, well, you want to tell him, Wade?
Yes, that book was called The Serpent and the Rainbow.
The Serpent and the Rainbow.
And that was a story, it was actually a popular book written based on my PhD research, which was a journey that I was asked to do to go down to Haiti to try to find the a formula of a folk preparation that was implicated in the creation of zombies. Now, zombies, of course, are not the image you have from these terrible Hollywood movies. The zombie in Haitian folklore is just the living dead. It's an individual who has been magically placed into the grave and then magically taken out by folk definition. But there were a series of cases that demanded investigation of individuals who really did apparently were apparently misdiagnosed dead, and then they turned back up in the realm of the living, and I was sent down to try to see if there was a folk toxin involved. But what was really actually exciting about that whole, investigation was the fact that, you know, I went down there to find the chemical basis of a social event and found myself exploring the social, spiritual, psychological, historical, political dimensions of a chemical possibility. You know, it's funny, voodoo is always seen as this black magic cult. Well, of course, it's nothing of the sort. If I asked you to name the great religions of the world, what would you say? Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, whatever. There's always one continent left out, sub-Saharan Africa, and the tacit assumption is that somehow black Africans had no religion. Well, of course, we know by ethnographic fact that they did. And all voodoo is a distillation of these very profound religious ideas that came over during the tragic era of slavery and then were sown in the fertile soil of the New World and grew in that soil.
Wow. Thank you.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. How did you become interested in ethnobotany?
Well, you know, as an anthropologist, David, I never could quite understand, and my first degree was in anthropology, and I never could quite understand how I was supposed to go down to the field, turn up at an indigenous community, say, in the northwest Amazon, announce that I was there for 6 months. By the way, you're going to feed me, house me, and guess what? I'm here to study your sex life. I mean, if someone did that to us, we'd call the police. And so very early on, and I was raised in British Columbia, and I spent a lot of time in hunting camps and logging camps and a lot of time with the First Nations of British Columbia. And I always had a certain affinity for indigenous cultures, but I learned very early on that you had to find the right conduit to culture in some sense. You had to find the right metaphor, the right means to break down the inherent barrier that existed by definition between yourself and the people with whom you found yourself living as a guest. If, for example, you wanted to study the myths of the Athabascan elders in northern Canada, you had to become a hunter, because the myths were nothing more or less than an expression of the covenant that existed between predator and prey, and a way of rationalizing the terrible fact that you had to kill, as an indigenous person, the animals upon the thing you loved most, which was the animals upon which you depended. And then by the contrast, when you go to the Amazon, which is a place of plants, water, and silence, where the forest is so important in the lives of the people that there are actually some indigenous societies who do not cognitively distinguish the color blue from the color green, because the canopy of the forest is like the canopy of the heavens, of the sky. Obviously, the conduit to culture was a botanical realm, and you could go there as a young botanist, and that purpose was the most reasonable thing they had ever heard from an outsider. And of course, because gossip is the international language, you could learn anything you wanted about the intricate details of the community life as you collected plants in the forest.
I have talked to some anthropologists who have really questioned the traditional practice of ethnography because it follows that sort of model that you outline, and because the ethnographer has so often been white European, bringing a lot of sort of first world intellectual baggage with them. And for that reason, I think some people now, younger people studying anthropology, have felt that maybe it would be more appropriate for them to study their own cultures rather than go do the traditional Margaret Mead kind of thing.
Well, I think it's true that for far too long, anthropologists, particularly the way they wrote, presented themselves as if they were these sort of objective flies on the wall of whatever culture they were visiting, and that their personality and character had nothing to do with their interactions. And of course, that is absurd. I mean, you bring to the experience yourself, and there's a constant dialectic between you and the people with whom you're living. And a lot of the success or failure of one's field research is based on that relationship, and that relationship is often created by the most simple issues of the human spirit, gesture and repartee, kindness. I mean, people often ask me, you know, how did you, quote-unquote, get the formula of the zombie drug? And you know, they want to hear that this was some kind of, you know, dangerous or macho, you know. And, of course, it's nonsense. If you do, you know, that never, even if you wanted to adopt that kind of guise, it would never get you anywhere. It would just get you in trouble. I mean, usually it is empathy, compassion, all the most enviable and desirable of human traits that resonate in a cross-cultural setting. Now, the idea that anthropologists, however, have no purpose and no right or no legitimate role to play in bringing to light the structures and the complexities and the wonder of these cultures, I think is very wrong. I think if you look, in fact, that very often it is the outsider who can drop into a culture and distill from its essence some portrait of it, which is very useful. I mean, for example, I know nothing about voodoo compared to any number of voodoo priests that I was with in Haiti. At the same time, if you want to explain to those who know nothing about voodoo what it is and its context, I can probably do a better job simply because they know so much that they not just get lost in the details, they have no external reference points. I can distill, not just myself, but in many cases anthropologists can distill from the culture. That allows me, for example, to take a phenomenon like the Haitian zombie, which has been used in an explicitly racist way to denigrate a people, and make sense out of sensation and show that it has a purpose within the culture and that it has value within the culture and that it's just one small thread woven through the fabric of that culture. You know, there are many places around the world, if we had not had anthropologists doing what, you know, Margaret Mead did, or others of her generation, the indigenous cultures would have no memory, virtually, of what their rituals were. I recently spent time in the Orinoco Delta with a marvelous group of people called the Winikina Warao. Now, I was with a young anthropologist who had been there 3 years, but his father had worked, Johannes Wilbert, one of the great anthropologists of America, had been with the Warao for 35 years. He had recorded in immense detail every aspect of a world that no longer exists, both a world of the physical plane, but of the spiritual plane, and his books, in some sense, are invaluable repositories that can be turned to, not just by foreign students, but by the Warao themselves. And increasingly, you know, the role of ethnography is not foreigners or outsiders examining and studying a culture. It's a cooperative effort between two different worlds to bring to light the wonder of, you know, a situation. And I find myself now working as a in a sense, both an anthropologist, but in my work with Cultural Survival, the human rights organization based in Cambridge at Harvard, you know, we work as colleagues with indigenous people around the world, working on the issues that concern all of us. So in that sense, this kind of relativism or this idea that somehow we have no, you know, no goal and that you know, we should just, you know, there's no, we should just come back and stay in our own culture, I think is really wrong.
Hmm. Has there ever been a place where you have gone and you have said to yourself, if you could, if you had no ties, and I know that you have family and so forth, but that if you could, you would say, well, maybe I'll just stay here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are certain places in the world that I, you know, really resonate with me as an individual, and certainly one of them would be southern Peru and the highlands of southern Peru. I find the history that comes through the landscape, the relationship that the people still have with the spirit of the earth as they see it, the memories of the Inca and the ruins that cling like memories to those mountains, I find it extraordinarily compelling. And in fact, I'm considering moving down there for a couple of years.
It's the life of the Inuit. Part of what this essay is about, obviously, is how, and perhaps one way or another, all of them are about, is how people's lives have changed as a result of their contact the modern industrial developed world. There, at one point here, you're near the end of this essay, you're talking about how the way of life of these people has changed and how they have adapted. And you write, how can we expect the people not to adapt? The Inuit language is alive. The men are still hunters. They use snares, make snow houses, know the power of medicinal herbs. But they also own boats, snowmobiles, television sets, satellite phones. And it prompts the question about just how much of an indigenous culture do people have to hang on to before they're no longer the people that they were?
It's a really critical question. No one wants to freeze a culture from the past. No one wants to reduce a culture to a zoological curiosity. The idea that cultures don't change is completely wrong. In fact, cultures are constantly changing. The idea that they're bound to inevitably fade away is wrong as well. Change itself doesn't destroy a culture. A culture survives when it has enough confidence in its past and enough say in its future to maintain its spirit and essence through all the changes it will inevitably undergo. Indigenous cultures only disappear when they are overwhelmed by external forces or when the drastic sort of conditions imposed upon them from the outside come with such speed and such force that it renders them incapable of adapting to these new possibilities for life. I think that you see that all over the world. For example, I just came back from time amongst the Rendili and the Samburu in northern Kenya, and the Areal, which is kind of a fusion of the two cultures. Now, those people are pastoral nomads. They live on the edge of the desert. They are fully capable of retaining their culture and still having access to proper veterinary medicine. I've also recently returned from living in Borneo with a group called the Penan, the last nomads of Southeast Asia. Now, the Penan are perfectly capable of interacting with the modern world. In fact, they've traded with outsiders for all of their history. But what's happening to them is that they are living in a nightmare where their homeland is suffering from the highest rate of deforestation in the tropical world, and there is now no place in that homeland free of the sound of machinery. The issue for the Penan is their subsistence base. They have traditionally relied on a forest that now falls in pieces all around them. And so when you remove the capacity of a people to live, that is really an act of ethnocide. And, it's very interesting because genocide is universally condemned, and no one even asks any questions about it. But ethnocide, which is the destruction of a people's way of life, is not only not condemned when it comes to indigenous peoples, it's often advocated as appropriate policy. Everybody wants to free indigenous people from their backwardness, but that usually means freeing them from who they are. And after all, what does backward mean? Usually it means that the people do things that governments disapprove of. The Penan, create resistance to the logging and bring international attention to the plight of the Borneo rainforest. They are then said to stand in the way of development, which becomes grounds for taking away their homeland and destroying their way of life. And then their disappearance is described as inevitable, as such archaic people can't be expected to survive into the modern world. Well, this is simply wrong. Indigenous cultures are always, changing. And that brings up an interesting analogy with languages. You see, languages, too, are always changing. And generally, languages have come and gone through history. Latin, for example, is no longer a language spoken in the streets of any city. But before it died, it had time and a chance to give birth to descendants. And there are now as many as 30 languages that are descended from Latin. Now what is happening is that the crush of the modern world is wiping out these languages with such speed that they have no time to leave descendants. And I think, to get back to your question, David, when do you say a culture is no longer a culture? I think it has to be when the language is no longer taught to children. Hmm. Because language, as I mentioned earlier, is not just it's not just vocabulary or grammar. It's far more than that. It's the entire repository of knowledge that people have. And when we sacrifice a language, as a linguist I recently interviewed said, we might as well drop a bomb on the Louvre, because these cultures, particularly the cultures with no written language, and they didn't have overt wealth. Their wealth was what was inside their minds, locked in memory and their imagination. And we go about blithely wiping this out without even knowing it was there.
Let's talk with another listener. And this person is in Greenup, and it's line 4. Hello.
Thank you.
Yes?
I've listened to you with great interest, Dr. Davis. I also have an ethnobotanist in my family. Did you study under Dr. Richard Schulte?
Yes, I did. And in fact, my book, One River, that David mentioned in the introduction, is actually a biography of Professor Schulte's.
Oh, I must read that. How is he?
He's very elderly now, and he's had some physical difficulties, but as long as the subject is still on plants, he's as acute as ever.
I met him several years ago. He's easy to talk to and has a great sense of humor.
Perhaps you should tell the other listeners, ma'am, who Schulte's is. He's not known to everybody outside the ethnobotanical world. This is the man who is a legend in the field of ethnobotany. He's really the father of ethnobotany. He's a man who sparked the psychedelic era with his discovery of the magic mushroom in Mexico in the 1930s, and then he went on to be the greatest Amazonian plant explorer of this century. He collected over 30,000 plants. He documented the use of over 2,000 medicinal plants. He discovered and described over 300 species new to science, which is an astonishing achievement in a career that has spanned now 40 years or 50 years of field work.
I talked to him about hallucinatory drugs, and he did not, at that time, approve of the U.S. drug policy. And could you agree with him?
No, I mean, I think the U.S. drug policy will be seen as an act of pure folly 100 years from now. You know, it totally ignores the reality of the world. The truth of the matter is that anthropology teaches us that peoples all around the world, for whatever reason, have a desire to periodically change consciousness through one means or another. In almost all cultures who have a chance to do so, they found in their environment some plant stimulant or that allows them to sail away on the wings of trance and get into those distant metaphysical realms where they can work their deeds of medical rescue, or they can seek some spiritual inspiration. We also use stimulant plants in our society, but because we define the use of drugs as being bad, we dismiss these substances as with euphemisms, so that tobacco is no longer a drug. It becomes a quick smoke, or coffee is a coffee break, and alcohol is a cocktail party. But in fact, these are very powerful drugs that we habitually use as well. When we look into Indian cultures, we can find that we can ask a very important question. What is it that they know about these substances that we don't know? Why is it that we, after 40 years of a war on drugs, have more people using more drugs in worse ways than ever before, and we found no conceivable way to end this terrible situation, and yet indigenous people have used these substances for thousands of years with no evidence of addiction, let alone toxicity. What is it they know we don't know? Well, one thing they know is that the use of these substances is a normal thing to do if done carefully. They recognize that this basic human desire is so ubiquitous in the human record that it has to be seen as part of a basic part of the human appetite. Secondly, they use their plants in a natural form, which is by any pharmacological definition the safest way to absorb a substance. It's a stunning anecdote, for example, that the first morphine addict was the wife of the man who invented the hypodermic syringe. Tobacco only became a really dangerous drug with the invention of the cigarette and the cigarette machine and the blonde strains of Virginia tobacco that allowed you to inhale tobacco deeply into the lungs. A perfect example of a good way of using a drug is is coca, the source of cocaine, versus cocaine hydrochloride, the alkaloid taken out of the leaf. We spent 2 years in South America for the U.S. Department of Agriculture on a grant that Schultes had secured, studying the botany, ethnobotany, and ethnography of coca use. And one of the things that Tim Plowman, who I write about in the book One River, and also mentioned in the new book Shadows in the Sun, who was the head of this project, did, to the horror of the backers of the U.S. government, is he did the first nutritional analysis of coca. And recall that the coca fields, the effort to eradicate the coca fields, had been underway for half a century before there was any illicit drug problem in this country. And when Tim did the first nutritional study of coca, he found out that, yes, it had a small amount of cocaine in it, roughly half to 1% dry weight, roughly analogous to the amount of caffeine in a coffee bean. And if you took caffeine out of coffee and made crack caffeine and smoked it, you'd have a drug abuse problem. But nobody in the DEA and the federal government who go to these drug abuse conferences notice the irony of them all bolting for the coffee pot at 10 o'clock in the morning to compare the cocaine that they extract from coca leaves with the leaf itself is as inappropriate as comparing the luscious fruit of a peach with the prussic acid you find inside the pit of a peach. But in addition to the small amount of cocaine that was absorbed very gently through the mucous membranes of the mouth and served as a mild and useful stimulant in a harsh and unforgiving environment, the leaves also were full of vitamins. They had more calcium in them than any plant that had ever been assayed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which made it perfect for a diet that traditionally lacked a milk product. It even was suggested that the leaves had enzymes in them that enhanced the body's ability to digest carbohydrate at high elevation, which made it perfect for the potato diet. So in one elegant assay, Timothy, under the direction of Schultes, showed that this plant that had been so maligned was in fact a fundamental part not only of the spiritual world of the Andes, but of also the nutritional regime of the people. And that put into stark contrast and profile the draconian efforts that were underway even then in the early 70s to eradicate the fields with the poisons that to this day pollute the headwaters of the Mother Amazon. And, you know, the truth of the war on drugs, as anyone close to it knows, is that the main federal elements, the DEA and all the various agencies, haven't the slightest interest in winning the war on drugs because they'd all be out of work and they'd no longer have that enormous federal financial pot to divvy up. The truth of the matter is that I think it's very clear that all the efforts that we've made over the years haven't really done anything to change the nature of drug use in America. Remember that in general, whenever drugs come into a culture, there's always a period of adjustment. You know, that this goes back a long way in history. Don't forget, for example, that there was a time in England when you could not walk in the streets smoking tobacco, but there later came a time that if you did not smoke tobacco, you couldn't graduate from prestigious schools. There was a time when coffee and chocolate and tea were banned in Europe, and then they became standard beverages of the table. And in fact, you can even see the social ramifications of coffee and tea and caffeine in the transformations of culture and history in the 18th century. Until the arrival of those stimulants, chocolate from the New World, from Central America, coffee from Abyssinia, and tea from China, most beverages in Europe were alcoholic. The water supplies of medieval cities could not be trusted. They were too full of pathogens, and most of the citizens of Europe got by on these mildly fermented beverages, beer or meat or whatever, but the whole population was mildly besotted all the time. And then suddenly these stimulants come in, and you have the coffee house and the chocolate house being developed, and instead of being besotted with alcohol, everybody's in there having coffee and getting a caffeine buzz on, and they can't shut up. And as they can't shut up, they start noticing that the guy who's in Versailles got kind of a bigger place than me, and before you know it, you've got social upheaval and revolution. There's no question that you can trace some elements of the upheaval of the 16th, but especially the 17th and 18th century, to the general consumption of these stimulants in Europe. So, in other words, every culture has to come to terms with drugs. I think that the vast majority of Americans have come to terms with most of these illicit drugs and have come up with a good relationship to them, and that relationship often involves abstinence. But I don't think, for example, that if drugs were decriminalized tomorrow, you'd see a tremendous upsurge in use of these substances. I think most people have already made their own decisions about whether they're going to use these drugs or not, because these drugs have been around us and so easy to get for so long.
Oh, this is fascinating.
And let me say one more point, ma'am. I mean, that, you know, it's so, this whole issue has become so politicized that even to say what I've just said is to be labeled a drug advocate. I don't use drugs. I don't like drugs particularly. My children don't use drugs, and my wife doesn't use drugs. But I live in Washington, D.C., and the streets of my city where my children walk are dangerous. Are they dangerous because of the drugs? No. They're dangerous because of a policy that criminalizes drugs, creates an enormous profit motive for the criminal element. And I maintain that the only way we'll ever get out of this terrible situation, a situation that not only threatens our own cities, but is tearing apart the social fabric of wonderful countries like Peru, Ecuador, Bolivia, but Colombia in particular, the oldest democracy in Latin America. The only way to get out of that is to break the profit motive, break the reason for the criminal class to market these drugs. And to do that, the only way I can imagine doing that is either bringing in punishments so draconian that they would violate the U.S. Constitution, or do something to decriminalize the substances so the price of them would drop.
Then you would agree that we farmers here in Illinois should be allowed to raise hemp?
Hemp is a plant that has been used as a medicine, as a food, as fiber, as a drug, and an oil. It's a five-purpose plant that's been used for thousands of years. There's much to say about marijuana. I don't particularly like marijuana. I think it ruins parties. It does crazy things to people's appetites, and some people have a good relationship to it. But I don't particularly like its effects. But I can tell you this, that in all the years of study, there's been almost, I can't think of a single example of morbidity or mortality that has come about from the use of that plant. Tobacco, by contrast, a plant that was also a sacred plant of the Indian peoples. Of course, cannabis comes from the old world, tobacco from the new world. But tobacco, only in the last 15 years or so have we finally come to realize what a dangerous drug that is. And here's a drug that's killed more people in this century than war. It's a drug that 90% of the users become addicted, begin to use it before they're 18 years old, and it's one of the hardest addictions to break, as anyone knows who's tried to give up tobacco. It's a substance which has been traditionally marketed by the government, and government made money off of it. In other words, you know, we've given so many mixed signals to our children about the nature of drug use over the years that it's no wonder that they're all confused.
Thank you so much.
All right, thanks for the call. I want to follow up on this question, and unfortunately, we're getting to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes left, and it's maybe almost too big to raise. But I guess I want to have you talk a little bit about, respond to the criticism some people might make, that to make comparisons between the use of psychotropic substances in traditional societies and the way people recreationally use drugs today in the modern industrial world is comparing apples and oranges.
Well, I think it's very important to recognize that one of the, you know, I was saying to the lady who called in, what can we learn from indigenous people? Well, one of the things that the indigenous people do with these substances is they recognize that the use of them is a legitimate thing in a cultural setting, but critically they also envelop that setting in a protective cloak of ritual that limits the use of the substances and puts a meaning and a purpose to that use. The other thing we have about, we forget why the indigenous people are using these substances. Fundamentally, You know, the role of the shaman has been much misinterpreted. The shaman is often seen as this sort of, you know, benign father figure, you know, who sort of has bells and rattles. I mean, I've never met a shaman who wasn't a little off. I mean, that's their job. I mean, they're the ones that the society empowers to go into the realms that the rest of us don't even want to know exists. I mean, Joseph Campbell said they're the ones who are sent into the waters that the rest of us would drown in. They take these substances for a very simple reason, that diseases in these cultures are defined in quite different ways, not by the presence or absence of pathogens alone, but by a state of balance. And disease is imbalance, disequilibrium in the individual. Diseases can be treated on two very different levels. They can treat diseases symptomatically, much as we do, only in place of medicinal drugs, they use medicinal plants, many of which, of course, are the source of our medicinal drugs, and many of which are pharmacologically active. But critically, treating disease symptomatically for these societies is seen as being somewhat mundane, because it doesn't get to the root, the spiritual root, where they believe the imbalance originates. And to get to that place, the shaman must invoke some technique of ecstasy to soar away on these wings of trance to get into those realms. That's the role of these sacred plants. They're never seen as drugs. They're seen as vehicles to the gods. And the experience itself is never perceived to be, in some sense, recreational or even inherently pleasant. I mean, I remember experimenting with some of these substances in the Amazon in ritual context. And I remember someone turning to me and said, you know, ayahuasca, the vision vine of the Amazon, for example, he said, you know, ayahuasca is many things, but pleasant is not one of them. They're not supposed to be pleasant. You know, when the shamans speak of facing down the jaguar, it's because they really do.
We're just about at the point where we're going to have to finish, and my apologies, we have some callers we can't take, but I think we're probably going to have to leave it at that. So much that we could talk about, perhaps on another day we can talk some more, but for right now I think we'll have to say thanks very much, that we appreciate you giving us so much of your time.
Well, thanks very much, David.
Our guest, Wade Davis, if you'd like to read the book that we have mentioned here, Shadows in the Sun, it is out now. It's published by the Island Press, and he is the author of a number of other books. You can seek him out at the library or at the bookstore.